You're listening to Legends Cast, a proud member of the Camp Legend Podcasting Network. This episode is brought to you by listeners like you. To become a supporter of the show, visit patreon.com/camplegend.
How do we do this intro thing?
I don't remember all the things he says. Screw it, we're doing it live.
We can leave this in.
This is funny.
Welcome everybody back to Legends Cast, a podcast about card games and the people that play them and the community around them. I think he says something like that sometimes. Mark is out this week. Once again, it is Gibby and I. I'm Deadbrook Nerd, for the record. See, I can't do this introduction.
And I'm Gibbles and Bits.
This is hard. How does he do this?
We're going to tag team this effort. It's hard when we don't have a script. Like, I've got a script for
for
EOS Airwaves and all of that. But, you know, we're talking Lorcana today.
If you ever were doubtful that Mark is integral to the show, let that be erased. We need him back. This is now 2 weeks where the monkeys are out of the cage. Gibby and I are just off doing our own thing here. But with that, right, Mark is out. So we are waiting to start the November review of the next game, Monster Train.
All aboard.
Okay. So Monster Train is going to be the November review for, you know, this season of Legends Cast being starter set. So we will be getting into that starting next week with Mark back in the lineup, the three of us all together again, and it feels so good, or at least it will. But today we decided to not give you empty airspace on your Wednesday commute. We wanted to make sure we got some cool content out. And so we decided to do a return already, only a month later, a return to Disney's Lorcana, because there's a new set coming out and we're going to talk all about it. We're going to talk a little bit about what it's felt like playing Lorcana, because Gibby and I are still playing it on a weekly basis. Gibby's been competing in tournaments, getting real sweaty up in here. And so we're really excited to be talking a little bit more about Lorcana. So what you can expect from today's episode, we'll be talking a little bit about the existing meta of Lorcana. We'll be talking about, you know, some of the news. So the upcoming set, the re-release of Chapter 1, what that's going to look like. We're also doing a special thing we're trying out, which is we are going to be having a special update on the Pokemon TCG. And so giving a quick glimpse in. And so we'll talk a little bit more about that when that comes back around. New set there, some exciting stuff. And then we're just going to close you out with, I don't know, whatever exciting new gaming we're doing on the side as well. And then next week we'll be starting Monster Train. So some cool stuff going on.
Can we just title that segment Live from the Field that's coming up?
Like, yeah.
I like that. I like that as a segment, the segment name. Like, I know it's not like Legend theme, like we try to jam Legend in everything that we can.
That's right.
But like Live from the Field is really what it is, and I think that's going to be that's going to be the name now for that.
So we'll be introducing the new segment to the show, Live from the Field. That's okay. It's branded now. But Gibby, let's just immediately jump right in. No banter. Okay, people are in here for the juicy Lorcana content. Gibby, I want to talk a little bit about the existing meta, because here's what I want to... I have a confession to make. This is where I'm getting at this. I had been going to Lorcana every week on Sunday for a while, and I haven't gone in a month.
Okay.
And here's the thing. I could have gone a few of those weeks, and I didn't. I didn't feel like it. I wasn't motivated to go. Now, I think Lorcana is a fantastic game, but if I'm being honest, my store currently has not been running full tournaments. So it's not been a super competitive environment. It's been competitive play casually. And I feel like I've explored everything already. So if I'm not going to be playing competitively and there's not enough for me to experiment with, I just didn't feel the motivation to go. So I'm curious to get your impressions on this first set. Was the first set a success? I mean, obviously financially you can probably safely bet it was a financial success, but from a game component, is this concerning that it got stale for me too fast? Where do you land on this?
No, I think your thoughts are, you bring up a great point. Here's where I land on it. Lorcana being, I think the first set itself, this as a chapter one, as they're going to call it, and as we'll refer to it, chapter one I would claim as a success. Now, that the only caveat to that is it is very well documented at this point that the pitfall of Chapter 1 has been the release of the physical cards and the lack of availability for everyone to be able to collect the cards in a quantity enough that is sufficient to make the decks that they people desire across the board. You really have a rarity of pulling some of the super rares or the enchanted or legendaries, whatever it is, that require you to build some of the top decks. And it sucks that you can't always build the top decks unless you're willing to kind of spend a pretty penny in the singles market online in order to get those, or you just get lucky, or you found enough product like I did, luckily. I mean, my horseshoe came in. The horseshoe that we've got, that Curry and I have talked about, is embedded in my heart. Came in handy over the past month or two trying to collect Chapter 1 cards. And I don't even have, I still, of all the product that I pulled, the only time I've ever seen an enchanted was the one that we pulled together when we were in Lexington. And we ended up actually selling for a decent amount of money. And then we split amongst the three of us to go back towards the show. But I have yet to see an enchanted and very few legendaries, truthfully. I have several legendaries for decks, like a couple here and there that not consolidated enough to make some of these top meta decks. But outside of that, if I evaluate chapter one, I do think it is a success. Mm-hmm. Nothing came out of this meta, or nothing came out of chapter one overwhelmingly broken, where it was like the deck to play and it was unbeatable. Every deck that surfaced that people experimented with and are still experimenting with was beatable. Now, are there decks that have been winning tournaments more consistently, have been played more often because they seem to be faring better? There's top dogs, sure. But it's not there's nothing that was so broken that like they didn't test it or it got released with
concern. Here's something that I'm gonna pitch to you. I have two thoughts on this, and then I think that I want to say these because I think it will contextualize the things that I'm really excited about for the future set. There's two big things. First, the meta got solved too fast, and I think that's something they need to watch out for. The second thing I'll say to this is the reason why the meta got solved too fast, and the problem I had with the first chapter, which is the power discrepancy between cards was drastic. There was a drastic discrepancy in power.
In rarities.
And tied to rarities, certainly, but also in general, right? Where a lot of the commons are, there's a lot of, I don't want to say useless commons, because within the context of it's the first set, theoretically, most of every card could be played in a scenario, right? Because there's just not a lot of options. But there's a lot of cards that we will look back on in two sets. We will look back on cards from the first chapter and be like, wow, a third of this is fully unplayable and will never see the light of day. Because there's just this huge like gap between something like Rapunzel, the legendary Rapunzel, and Flounder, right? And Flounder has no ability. It's just a blank 1-mana 2/2. There's a lot of blank cards. Now, it's fine for that to set a baseline, but I was disappointed with how many cards were blank. I mean, I hate to be this way, but how come one of my favorite characters, Pumbaa from Lion King, is a blank 4-drop? He's got such a cool, exciting character, all this history behind Pumbaa, and he's a blank 4-drop. Right. So like my point is the reason the meta got solved so fast is there's this large swath of cards that are basically gap fills in decks, and pretty obviously so. So the decks that are the best are the decks which aren't gap filling with blank cards, a.k.a. a lot of the control decks, a.k.a. a couple of the aggro decks where it's not just about questing. It's also, you know, some sort of additional effect outside of like the Lilos, which are like, you know, not, they are blank, but they have a ridiculously weighted 2 lore pips for 1 cost. Right. And so that almost can be seen as an effect in that it is, you know, a disproportionately weighted card from a statistical perspective. Right. But you have, yeah, like, you know, the decks that are like the Ruby Amethyst Control. I don't think there's any cards in that deck that don't have an effect.
Yeah, and I do think I have less of a problem with the vanilla stat sticks for a chapter one than maybe you do, because I think it gives the game room to grow, and it also helps the game learning, because I think there's context to who is this game centered towards, and it's supposed to be a family environment kind of game, and they do have quite a bit of powerful or complex cards that have good text to them.
Yeah.
And I think maybe the stat stick cards of certain ink numerical values, ones, twos, threes, fours, even going all the way up to fives, like they've dug Jumbo Jakiba, for example, as a five drop in Emerald is just a stat stick.
And why is that a rare is my point.
Yeah. So like, oh, and now that's a different question.
That's a different question. But I'll also say this: if you look at, I think he's a maybe
the,
not.
There's the white symbol at the bottom.
Yeah, that's uncommon. There's a few stat stick rare cards like Maui, right? Like 8/8 Maui.
Are you talking about the captain?
I think that's what I was thinking about. Ganyu. Ganyu, that is what I was thinking about.
Gantu, I'm sorry. Right. Gantu.
Whatever.
Yeah, Captain Gantu.
I don't know all the names from the
Captain Gantu is a legendary.
And that's a legendary, and it's like tragically bad.
Yeah, and he's like, oh, no one can touch me.
It's unplayable. It's unplayably bad, yeah. So, you know, okay. But, like, if you look at that compared to some of the ridiculously powerful cards elsewhere, you do kind of look at it and you go, you know, here's a great example. Like, both of the red Aladdins are very elegantly designed. Not a lot of text to them, right? Like, the first one comes into play, the opponent loses a lore. That's an easy to understand, family friendly card that still does something. And then you have the 7 cost Aladdin, which, despite being like a signature card that had a starter deck, was the rare card in the starter deck, the super rare in the starter deck, it has shift and it steals 2 lore whenever it takes somebody out. Like, that's not a complex effect, but it is a strong and impactful effect. And I would have liked to have seen a few more cards, you know, scaled appropriately across the costs that were doing that. Because if you think about it, like, of all the blank cards, all of the blank stat stick cards, to my knowledge, only 2 of them are seeing regular play. Some of the 1 mana 2/2s, right, which are just gap fills in decks that don't have other 1-drop options with effects. So you'll see like a lot of Amethyst aggro decks run copies of Archimedes because they only have 4 Pascals, but they need more 1-drops. So as soon as the Archimedes can be replaced with a better 1-drop with a more impactful effect, they will be, right? Then the other one is Cerberus, which is like the only example of mid to high cost stat stick card that's being played. And it's because it's a 5/6 for 5, which can trade up into Tinkerbells and things like that without also being. So it's purely a math relative to the meta perspective on that. And those are really the only blank cards they're seeing play. So
I'll give you 2 other ones.
Okay.
Just for context. So there is the 1-drop Maleficent in purple that's got the
I kind of mentioned this earlier. I was like, I don't consider like those the lore heavy blanks to be part of this conversation. Like, so okay, disproportionately lore statted. I'm talking
so
about
then we, so then we can throw that Maleficent out. The other one that I would say I do see in some meta lists being played in amber is the 3-drop Mr. Smee, because it is a 2/5 for 3 at blank. So it is a really good target to be able to put out, live, and also trade into to be a heal target for 4-drop Rapunzel for card draw.
Yeah, so I haven't seen that one as much, but I'll take your word for it.
It's almost like it's about in 50% of like the list for like the Steel Song lists or an aggro amber, sapphire list.
Right.
So that one's there, but stat line is a bit unique in what it offers.
I like that kind of design. If something's going to be blank, make it have really warped stats so that it has like a theoretically an interesting angle, like Mr. Smee or something like Maleficent for a 1-cost Maleficent Lilo. That's where the lore comes in as an extra design component. But there's a lot of blank, you know, like
one-drop Stitch also does because it's a...
A shift target, right, which is a little bit different, but you're never playing that card for its stats or lack of effect. You're only playing it because you want to shift Stitch, which is a fine, which is fine. I'm just saying, like, there was a lot of cards that felt dead to me, which and more in a lot of cards, like a lot of items that were dead because they were way overpriced. Like they clearly screwed up on the pricing of items in the base set, which again, fine. I'm not here to be overly critical. I'm just stating, I'm stating this because we're going to transition into the next set in a second. And I think a lot of those problems that I just brought up and the reasons I felt like the game for me became stale really quickly because I didn't feel like I could experiment, that's going to be resolved. Spoiler alert. That's going to be resolved.
So, and I will say this as kind of our last point on chapter one before we transition into focusing on the upcoming release that is November 18th in the local game stores for the Floodborne chapter two.
Yep.
Is revolving around chapter one. We talked about, and you mentioned that you felt like the meta was solved too quickly.
Yeah.
I agree and disagree with you in certain places. And I also, so what came out initially in the meta early on in chapter one, green, yellow aggro was like the deck to play.
Well, and Ruby Amethyst
control. And Ruby Amethyst control. Now, Ruby Amethyst control has maintained a high level of play because of the top end cards and the ability to scale into the late game. Like that was always something that people figured out how to do, and it remains relevant because nothing else came to dethrone it. Because the aggro list wasn't outpacing the control list, so the control list remained. People got better at playing the control list, and it knocked out the aggro list from top level play because it was too counterable. Also, people started to figure out how to play mid range lists a little bit better and refining those. And I think that also does quite well against the heavy aggro list.
It does better.
Especially if you're going to play something like Steel, that's got a lot of single target removal, which in chapter one is a little harder to come by for all of the ink colors. There's a couple ink colors that do it better than others.
Yeah, you're right.
And the couple in colors that do have the removal to be able to counter some of those aggro lists are doing really well in the meta right now. So I do think we saw almost like an iteration one for like a month or two, and then an iteration two that we've now settled into and maintain of the meta, but it is relatively solved now at this point.
Right.
And I also don't think that that's a, I don't think that that was necessarily bad or okay. Not bad. I don't think it's a surprise.
No, it should. I fully agree with that. So let it be known, I'm not trying to hold this to the standards of a game that's been out for multiple expansions, right? Because when a game like Hearthstone becomes solved in 2 weeks, that's a big problem because it's got six sets it's pulling from, right?
So what's wrong?
So what's wrong, right? This is one set. My larger point is only to say that that was disappointing for me in conjunction between the meta got solved quickly, which is fine in and of itself. And two, there was a lot of blank cards, which impacted your ability to dig deeper into experimentation and deck building. And actually, you know, three, you can't get the rare cards that are there because they're really expensive and you have to drop a ton of money. And, you know, Dead Broke Nerd doesn't have a job yet. So, you know.
And in a way, actually, and I will say this, the lack of being able to attain the top tier cards because of the rarity blocks and just it being expensive has actually made the local game store in-person play interesting because nobody has those cards.
Well,
so therefore people are experimenting with the exception of a couple top people.
I am glad that has been your experience because in my local game store, there is a massive gap, which is really frustrating to see. I think people are handling it really politely. Like I think people are being really nice about it. But the truth is you had a couple fans that were prowling every single store on release day, hit on a couple places, bought multiple boxes of cards, like $500 to $1,000 of cards, cracked them all, built all the decks, and then, you know, admittedly, and I'm not trying to disrespect these people. It's their money, right? They can do what they want with it, right? But, and some of them were really nice about bringing in the extra commons and uncommons for folks who didn't have access to any of the cards to flesh out at least their starter decks. But the difference in power level between the people that bought all the cards when they existed, and now nobody can catch up over time is really stark. And so it's a bummer to watch. You know, there's a couple people, myself included, that come in and they basically have one, or like I myself have one deck that is competitively viable against the top meta, and I don't have enough cards for anything else to handle it. And the only way I would be able to change that is if I wanted to drop 20 plus bucks, you know, per card on the rares that will allow me to play other things up to that same level. So, and then that's not even accounting for all of the kids that have been picking up the game, which is really exciting to see a young crowd come in and, you know, embrace, you know, CCGs, and also to see their parents coming in and picking it up. But like, they can't get cards that would help them upgrade, and they're playing against people with blinged out Ruby Amethyst control decks who are, great, nice people, but like also their intent is to win, and they're in the wrong setting for that. But that cannot be directly correlated to the design's flaw outside of some rarity issues, which again, I'm excited to say, I think is going to be resolved a little bit. So let's start to talk about Flood.
Yeah.
The only thing I wanted to say before this is that there is going to be a re-release of Chapter 1, which supposedly will hit stores. Some of it is coming with the release of Rise of the Floodborne.
Some of it's hitting now. I've seen in certain, and also the re-release of Chapter 1 is the United States market only.
Yeah, actually, I did read that European market is going to be shortly following. So that's
okay,
good news.
That's
for
good.
Them.
That's good.
Yeah, yeah.
They moved up the timeline from what it was supposed to be early 2024 in the United States. At least I can speak on that because you've seen
they wanted
the news
it here
Europe.
Before Christmas. Yeah,
yeah. So it's now going to be the holidays. Some local game stores. If you're still interested in playing Lorcana, I would still highly recommend it. It's been a fantastic game. Go look in your local game stores. Call around.
Especially
when
getting close to the end of next week, because that's when they're getting their restocks. So,
yes, they're getting the restocks. If your local game stores are starting to see cards, even if they don't have a whole bunch of cards to be able to sell to you at this point, or they're still holding them for events or whatever it might be, or creating a little bit of a singles vibe going on within your stores. Also, I actually ran into one of the third-party logistics guys that restocks Target when I was in there last week buying some other things and also just seeing if they had any products. I was interested to see if the restocks had hit the big box stores yet. He said, if you start seeing local, and this goes for pretty much any third party stocker that handles Target, Walmart, when you start seeing that hit the local game stores, give it about a week lag, and then you can start expecting to see it in Target, in Walmart, in Barnes and Noble, in GameStop, and Best
this
Buy
game
as well.
Is
in case you didn't know, Best Buy
happens.
Has it. They also do.
Yeah, this game's going to take off once that happens. Once there's actually stock and people aren't scalping it, this game is going to be huge. It's
and
really
I'm hoping
exciting.
It drives down the singles market too, because I do have interest in going and buying some singles. And once people aren't trying to sell them for absorbent amounts, hopefully we'll be able to kind of buy some cards.
And reminder, if you are interested in a soon to be irrelevant, but if you're interested in like figuring out what some of the best singles cards are, hit us up in the Discord because it's going to likely shift in terms of if there's really strong, cards from Chapter 1 that are going to be empowered by cards from Chapter 2. You could see that market go up. Personally, I've stocked up on a few rares that are currently not good in Chapter 1, but I believe and I'm projecting to be good in Chapter 2. I don't know when the last time we talked about that was, but it wasn't, it hasn't been recently. I would definitely grab some Moanas, which are under $1 a piece. I would definitely grab like one or two copies of Lady Tremaine.
Yep.
I was originally optimistic on Mulan. Now that I've seen more of the set, I'm less optimistic on it, but it's still cheap, so why not? And then grab some of the copies of the Hades villain.
Is the one I was
We're going to talk about that at the end, I think, but you and I need to get into that. So the big 8-drop Hades and the 4-drop Hades are both, the 4-drop Hades is just universally good.
It's one of my favorite cards in the game.
Yeah, it's underrated in the meta, to be honest. And then the 8-drop Hades is going to be very fun, playable, I think, budget deck, but also you can bling it out. So that'll be really cool. Let's get into, finally, hey, we're 25 minutes in. Sometimes we banter up until this point, so we're on our game here.
We're doing great. We're doing great.
We're doing great. We're doing great.
You're doing great, sweetie.
Thank you, honey. Let's get into the upcoming set, Rise of the Floodborn. Gibby, wow. First off, it's cool that it's coming out, like, I don't want to say this quickly, like it hasn't been a couple months, but like, you know, they were ready because clearly all these cards have been designed ahead of the game. And more importantly, there is a distinct difference in design approach
and vibe, like,
and vibe that too. Theme.
Oh, it's so cool. And they're expanding a lot of the IPs that they're like putting in. Like, so we saw very distinct brands or characters from movies that Disney like owns, that like from Disney movies that in chapter one that we were like, oh, this is really cool. It goes a lot of the classics, right? And even some ones that like, I don't know, I don't put a whole lot of stock into, like, oh, Merlin and like whatever, but like they in chapter two, we're seeing them branch. We're seeing them add not only other old movies and characters that we didn't see in chapter one, we're also seeing like updated new ones too. Like they're taking the whole timeline of Disney movies and they're hand picking characters and themes out of all of these different movies across the timeline of Disney. So that way there's recognizable characters and there's buy-in for those that watched the movies in the 80s on VHS and those ones and DVDs in the early 2000s and on Netflix or Disney Plus, I should say, probably in the 2020s. Like it's awesome what they're adding to it.
So with Rise of the Floodborn, you can hear in the name, what is Floodborn? Floodborn is a keyword which depicts a extremely like different variant of and you please look up the lore. We've explained
it's almost
in the past.
Like dystopian.
Yeah, I don't know if dystopian is it necessarily, but like alternate history sort of vibe or like alternate like lore. Look it up. They have lore on this. We've tried to decipher it before. We have not successfully done that, I don't think.
It's one of three subsets that currently exist. There's Storyborn, there's Dreamborn, and then there's Floodborn. Yeah. So Storyborn's supposed to be, as we understand it, accurate to the story, accurate to the movie or whatever
from
it
the,
is.
Yeah, from the lore.
Like it's
from
a good and accurate.
From the canon.
It's a canon accurate representation of the character from the movie.
Yeah.
Dreamborn is if they had changed one thing about the character, maybe an aspiration that they had or something that was either unrealistic or unrealized came to fruition, that was, it's more wholesome and like uplifting, with the exception of some of the villain characters. It's maybe like, what if they achieved their aspirations that were stated,
that, and then I'll buy into that. Yeah.
And then Floodborn is a major plot point detail has been changed about the character.
Alt
that
history
was, yeah, it's like an alt history. Like an alternate reality,
yeah.
Sort of like an alt Spider-Man reality kind of like thing where it's
into
like
the Spider-Verse.
Yeah, like it's something.
Someone
drastic.
Disrupted the canon event.
It's something drastic about the character that has changed, and therefore, like their whole identity is now different. Like Tinkerbell is huge, or like Hercules drank the last drop of the potion, and he's no longer a god, and now Hades sits on top of
Mount Olympus.
Mount Olympus.
That's
so, like,
a card, and
major,
it's a cool card.
Major plot point change.
Well, so regardless, they're clearly focusing on that Floodborn approach. So a lot of the high profile cards with Rise of the Floodborn, a lot of the rare cards or the cool, you know, splashy, expensive cards, they are Floodborn variants, which are really cool and typically feature the shift keyword.
Exclusively.
Feature the shift keyword, which is really cool, which allows you to bring in that character at a discounted price by overlapping it onto a different version of the character with the same name. So if you have a two cost Aurora, you can shift in the five cost Aurora for three instead. And there's some cool effects that go along with that. You're able to immediately use the character, whereas normally it would have a summoning sickness-esque effect. We've covered this in our past you know, coverage. And if this is totally new to you, if Lorcan is totally new to you, it's a great time to get into the game. Go check out our initial review across. We have four episodes covering it. We played in person. You can also check out our Patreon. This is where I'll plug it ruthlessly, where we previewed and played all of the initial starter decks against each other and reviewed those. And then we also played a draft. This is going to be the best game on the market for draft. I'm planting my flag on that. This is going to be the best game CCG on the market for draft, period. But let's dive in, because I think, Gibby, we were talking about this. How do we want to approach it? I think we're going to go color by color and just do a high profile overview. Do you want to lead us in talking about Amber, since that's like your pet project?
Yeah, I do love playing Amber. It's probably my most played color overall so far. So we're going to be talking more or less about high themes of what we've seen so far, because we are, like any exciting card game, we're in an exciting time of release season. So as we're approaching this November 18th date of Floodborne coming out to the public.
Previews, baby.
There's about half of the cards, and you said there's 208 in total. 204 cards in total, individual unique cards that will be released for Rise of the Floodborne in Chapter 2. We only know about half of them, maybe just over half of them at this point. Someone made a comment. It's like someone made a comment, I think, on the Facebook group that I'm a part of, the official Disney Lorcana TCG Facebook group, where it was a couple of days ago over the weekend previously, where they were like, we are officially halfway through the reveal cards. And I'm like, that's crazy to think that in less than 2 weeks at that point, these cards are hitting the market and we don't even know what half of them are.
Well, and especially because there are so few of these that are duds. And I previewed that before we talked about this. That was the big problem I had with the first chapter or whatever it's called, that there, it feels like there's so many cards. They could release the 121 cards that are currently previewed, and I would feel like there was so much to play with. These are crazy. So Gibby, Amber, like, what's cooking with Amber in this next set?
Yeah, so we've got some additional, so like Amber previously had some of the singers. And that will continue to remain. We just got a one drop Cinderella that can sing for three.
It's broken.
That's going to be awesome.
It's so cracked.
It's an inkable 1/1/2. Like,
it's
that's
so cracked.
And it's going to pair with other Cinderellas that you can shift into. It slots as a really good one drop in princess decks. Like, so you're going to continue to see some of them flesh out some of the princess synergies. Decent lore count values. That's something that Amber has as well, depending on the character. More on board tempo based. We were seeing some support characters in here as well. Support is a keyword that Amber had a little bit of, but I'm not surprised to see more of that. We're getting a Rapunzel shift. I think probably one of the biggest reveals that we've received so far.
Yeah.
To note for Amber is the Seven Dwarves. Along with the new Snow White as well. So Snow White is a 2-drop uninkable that says you pay 1 less ink for any of your 7 dwarf characters. And then they've released a different character for all 7 of the classic dwarves.
Yeah.
And what's funny about it too is someone lined it up. The art on all 7 of the dwarves is actually one continuous picture.
Oh, really?
Yeah, if you didn't know that.
That's awesome.
Yeah, so if you can either Google it or go look on the Facebook page. Someone has posted it.
Yeah, I'm looking at it now.
The art for all 7 of the dwarves, and I don't even think it's alphabetical order, but it's like a picture. If you line them up all side by side, it spans as one continuous like background art picture. Of all 7 of the dwarves, and they all synergize. So like some of them help you get out your other 7 dwarves cheaper, or some of them help you give the rest of their 7 dwarves more attack or more lore or debuff other characters as you play 7 dwarves. So there's an aggro synergy package of the 7 dwarves that we're going to be seeing predominantly in Amber, and then you can splash.
Well, and
something else with it too.
And I think that the 7 dwarves is going to be a kind of almost pre-built archetype, right? Which is like, obviously you're going to play all 7 dwarves probably. You're probably playing 3 to 4 copies of each, right? Uh-huh. And even if that's not the case, I mean, you're talking about like 20, 21 to, I would say upwards of, what is it? If you go, what's 8 times 4?
32.
Yeah. Over half your deck will probably be, you know, dedicated to this core group of characters. And you might, you know, run 2 or 3 copies of one and, you know, 4 of another. But what I want to say is
they're all uncommons.
They're all uncommons and commons. This is going to be the best budget deck for new players. It's simple to understand. The cards seem decent, and you can always upgrade it over time with, you know, and they synergize. They're all commons and uncommons, so you'll be able to put this deck together, have fun with the 7 Dwarves and Snow White package, and just swarm the board. Now, yeah, I'm thinking you pair this with Amber and just farm the card draw from Amber.
Oh, Amber and Amethyst?
Amber and Amethyst, yeah. Swarm is like that. That is what those two do well, is Amethyst draws you cards, Amber puts down cards, the characters that synergize with each other. So that'll be really cool.
You might also be able to make a decent Mulan deck out of this too.
I hadn't thought about that, but yeah, it's not a bad call.
I mean, is this going to be one of the best decks to go wide?
Yeah.
And I think Ruby will have some good denial of your opponent being able to build a board to answer it. I mean, I think a card like... Is it Hakuna Matata that gives you
that heals
all your characters for 2 or 3?
Yeah.
Yeah, and you can sing. Like, you can sing it. Like, you'll be just in range with any of your dwarves to be able to sing it, depending on the scenario. About half of your dwarves will be cost-effective enough to be able to sing it.
So
that's going to be a budget. That'll be a budget aggro deck to be able to put in there, too. But they're also fleshing out some of the top end as well for others. There's a new 6-drop Mickey Mouse.
Yeah.
That comes in whenever this character quests, play 3 less for the next character you play this turn. It's got 3 lore. So yeah.
I want to point out here that it's clear that with this card and 0 to Hero, which is a new 2-cost song, it's clear that Amber is becoming the discount character faction, right? You can cheat characters in for cheaper. Now, we already had a little bit of that with the Lantern in the previous set, and we're seeing even more of that here. You had Just in Time as well in the last set. So Amber is the discount character faction, which is kind of neat, and they're showing that is an intentional design thing here.
Maybe a broader stroke to be able to paint for Amber is that they are becoming one of the few very board centric.
That's true too. Yeah.
Board centric. I mean, because if you look at what I think is going to be one of the most bonkers cards so far that's been released, that's been previewed, and it was one that we got from the beginning, was, and that let us know that Floodborne is going to be for real, is the 5-drop The Queen, Commanding Presence. You can shift her in for 2. Whenever this character quests, chosen opposing character that you know is that you choose your opponent's character gets -4 attack, and your character, you can choose one of your characters to get +4 attack.
Yeah.
So basically just like trade for
value free. Value trading, yeah, for free.
Yeah, so that's going to be a really like strong like card to have in your deck that commands board presence.
I do want to profile, and I think what we can do is we can kind of briefly talk about a couple cards that are relevant to the themes of the faction, and then we can just sort of quickly profile a card like that. I wanted to quickly profile the most important card in my opinion for every level of play, aka not just super rare cards, which is the new Rapunzel. Now, previously, the most powerful card in the game, arguably in terms of like its value to the decks that it's in, was the 4-cost Rapunzel that was a legendary. It's still sitting around like $45 or something like that for a single copy. They have now printed an uncommon Rapunzel, also a princess. It's a 5-cost, but it shifts for 3. So if you have a cheaper Rapunzel, you can bring in a cheaper. And it has a fantastic effect that says when you remove 1 or more damage from your characters, again, Amber has a lot of healing synergies, you get to draw a card. Yeah, Dingle Hopper. You've got some blue overlap as well to help with healing. Coconut Basket. Timon as a 1-drop heals when he comes into play.
Jasmine,
right? So there's a princess deck in here that can draw through healing and then quest like no other. That I think is going to be really cool, and I would like to see this card, Moana, the Cinderella that heals, the new Cinderella that sings, are all in a deck. And by the way, a lot of those are either uncommons or cheaper, or uncommons or less rare, or they are cheap rares that you can build. So really exciting to see this card. I think it's going to see a lot of play. Will it see a lot of top level play? Maybe not, but this is a fantastic card to stock if you're just starting out and you need card draw. This game, and we're going to talk about this in a second when we start talking about Emerald, you need card draw in this game. You only draw one card per turn. You're incentivized to ink one and play one. So you need to be looking at what are my card draw options for whatever deck it is that you're putting together. So that Rapunzel's really cool. Where shall we move to, Gibby?
Let's go to Amethyst next. And do you want to take us through Amethyst?
Sure. This one's pretty simple. I'll go ahead and profile this. Amethyst, I think we could probably agree that while maybe it didn't have an individually strongest card, Amethyst was probably the best faction overall to play in the first chapter, or definitely one of them.
Yeah, card draw is just so hard to come by with the limited card pool, and that was the bread and butter of Amethyst, being that card draw. So you could pretty much create a tempo advantage into the mid to late game if you could stay ahead on cards with any Amethyst deck.
Right. You had basically Maleficent into Friends on the Other Side, two cheap uncommons or commons. I think they're both uncommons. They work synergistically into each other really well. So just a very good
Queen on five can tap for a card.
Queen on five, Ursula's Cauldron. You had a lot of ways to shape your hand throughout the course of the game, which is a great supplementary support package. And so what it seems that they wanted to do with this set, from what we've seen so far, is establish Amethyst give Amethyst options to be its own proactive theme, not just serving all of the other factions up with cards. So what they did was they have a very board-centric approach of challenger units, as well as this Wizard's Duel series of cards featuring Madam Mim and Merlin from the VHS classic animated movie, The Sword and the Stone. Gibby, did you watch this one?
Of course I did.
Oh, this is one of my favorite ones when I was a kid. And in the movie, one of the big battles, basically, is a hilarious shape-shifting contest between Madam Mim, this sort of creepy witch in the woods, and Merlin. And so they shapeshift into all these different animals and try to one-up each other. So with that in mind, there's a bunch of Merlin cards. Merlin has a crab form, a goat form, a rabbit form, and a squirrel form, as well as his standard human form. Madam Mim, on the other hand, has a snake form, a fox form, and a dragon form. And I think there might be one more to come. All of those tend to have their own package of abilities. So, for instance, there is this sub-theme going on of returning your own characters to your hand. So, Madam Mim tends to have really high stat or high power abilities that require you to return your own characters to your hand in order to play them out, right? So, things like the Madam Mim Fox. Right. So Madam Mim as a fox is a 3-cost inkable, which is nice. There's a lot more uninkables in the set, I think we noticed, Gibby.
To balance.
But right, which also, I think is good.
They're also raising the power level, I think, on average of some of the cards they're releasing too, which tends to be where you see some of your more powerful cards is in the uninkable realm.
Right. So this Madam Mim being inkable, of course, is an asset that we are paying more and more attention to what cards are inkable that are also have potent effects. So this being a 3-cost 4/3 that when you play it, you either banish her immediately unless you can return another character to your hand. But it has rush as a 3-cost 4/3. That is a better stat line than you will see coming out from the Zeus that is 4-cost that people like to play. But of course, coming with a consequence. And you see similar patterns along all of Madam Mim's versions. And meanwhile, for Merlin will come in and give you an immediate effect when it comes in and when it leaves play, something I think that's going to be really, really powerful. So you've got like the goat version of Merlin that comes in, gains you an immediate lore, which this is a really important thing to talk about. And I'm going to mention this in a second. Comes in, gives you an immediate lore, and also gives you a lore when leaving play. There's another version that does that with card draw. My point, though, is that this is the introduction of something new, which is from hand lore gain. We've seen it. We didn't have any of it in the first chapter. I don't think there was a single card in the entire first chapter that gained you a lore from hand on your turn, which means one of the key strategies playing in Lorcana is looking at your opponent's board and saying, how much can they quest for next turn? And if your opponent is sitting at 15 questing, but they only have 4 lore showing on the board, you know they can't get to 20. They will max out at 19 because they have no way to boost that is not, except for the Eye of the Fates, which is overpriced and no one plays it. That's the only card, right?
Steal from the Rich? But that's
no, that only makes them lose it.
Okay, then I think you're right.
There are cards that make them lose lore. So this is an introduction, and there's a Christopher Robin in Amber, but we are starting to see some from hand lore gain that is going to massively change the way that people think about playing around an opponent that is close to hitting 20, because they can no longer look at that, 19, and say, okay, you'll get to 19, but I know you won't get to 20, so I'm going to ignore your characters and play for my win in 2 turns, right? There's been this sort of cold hard math that hasn't been punished because there's no cards that can disrupt that math. So that exists now, and that's very important to note. So anyways, other cards or other themes going on here. You've got some more exerting of your opponent's characters. There's a Pinocchio that does that. There's also a new action card that does that with I'm Stuck, which shows Winnie the Pooh stuck in the hole.
Bother.
So some cool stuff in there. But that's really what we're seeing is it's a much more focused themes in Amethyst this go round. Whereas last expansion or the first expansion rather being something that was much more generalist. A lot of applications, a lot of it being more of a support faction, and now it's honing in on how does a mostly Amethyst deck want to win the game, and it does seem to be through these powerful entering play, leaving play effects. So some cool
stuff.
I think
Amethyst is one of the most susceptible to an early game, rush from other factions or an aggressive deck on the other side, mm-hmm. just because it wants to be able to get these effects out. In the mid range, or it requires some additional setup to really get the payoffs towards the mid to late game.
Right.
Not necessarily ramp focused, but more or less character focused and getting multiple effects out and kind of grinding you down over the course of the game by being able to produce more resources than you can. So I do think it is going to be susceptible based off of what we've seen to aggressive decks, but I also think it can be a good complement faction with the card draw and with some of these additional effects to a lot of what the other inks can do.
Yeah, very cool. That's all I've got on Amethyst. Gibby, do we want to jump into Emerald?
Yeah, let's go to Emerald. Emerald, I think, is going to be one of the most, if not the most, interesting faction or ink color coming out of the Floodborne. So from what we've seen so far, not only is it gaining a major power spike, Emerald is, by and large, probably one of the most non-existent ink colors in the top meta currently. A lot of the top decks and top strategy plays don't involve Emerald.
Which is a big pivot, because early on in the game's life, Emerald's aggressive questing was being profiled very heavily in a bunch of different variants of aggro. And so, well, obviously, it's not disappeared by any means completely, but the top lists typically are Amber Steel variants, Amethyst Ruby, some Sapphire and Steel, some Sapphire and Ruby and Sapphire and
real quick
Amethyst. It's much more later game strategies for the most part.
Yeah, from Pixelborn. So Pixelborn being the online client, which is free to play, and you can download all of the cards, and it doesn't require you to build the collection. It's actually a really great.
How has it not gotten shut down yet? That's the crazy thing to me.
I don't know. Yeah. But I think it's keeping the game alive right now. For those that can't get the cards, and it keeps them involved. To maybe it actually benefits Disney right now. But It's an online client that you can download. There's a Discord for it. It's actually a really helpful community, and you can download the pictures. It's very easy to get to, and it allows you to play all the cards and enjoy playing almost like in an online format while you, if you aren't playing in a local game store or don't have a local game store community. But they also have a rank ladder system on there too, and they keep stats. So for example, from October 27th to November 3rd is the most recent week of data that we have. Amber Steel was the, which is a song heavy deck along with A Whole New World that allows you to set, allows you and your opponent, you and your opponent have to ditch your hand, whatever you've got, and then you draw seven cards. You basically refill. Control Ruby Amethyst, almost mid-range Sapphire Amber, and then Emerald Steel. And I think people are playing Emerald Steel with anticipation for Floodborne. Those are the top four decks right now, but it's overwhelmingly Amber Steel, Ruby Amethyst, and Sapphire Amber. So Emerald really isn't in that mix anywhere. I think that's going to change in Floodborne. So we've seen some amazing cards come out for Floodborne so far for Emerald.
And for what it's worth, I still find a ton of success with Emerald personally. I still think it's very strong. My Emerald Amethyst midrange deck feels like it has a winnable matchup against everything. Now, that doesn't mean it's a favorable matchup. It just means that, like, there's no match.
It can compete.
It can compete in any, which is what I like. I like to play decks that have outplay potential.
Yeah.
And so that is what I've seen the most success with personally.
And my bread and butter deck also involves Emerald. It's an Emerald, Emerald Amber. I right on par actually with it's a strategy that I constructed leaning into that's off meta that I've really enjoyed and had a lot of success with. And before we knew any of the Floodborne cards,
yeah,
we started.
You and I were talking about this for weeks
and
before
we built this.
Anything.
We built the deck. I competed in local game tournaments with it, and like I took second in like a 40-person tournament with this Chapter One based discard deck.
Yeah.
Like not aggressive, but a mid-range discard deck. And lo and behold, what do we get out of Emerald in Floodborne? An overwhelming amount of discard synergy that is going to upgrade my deck and blow a lot of the cards out of the water. And I think it's going to be a premier deck in Chapter Two once all the Floodborne cards are released. So what we're seeing is a way for Emerald to not only control the early tempo of the game by getting some decently lore count pip cards out on board, but control your opponent's hand, which is an understated avenue to try to win a game of Lorcana. I mean, so not only do you control the cards that they can play on board, but you also control the Inkwell. I think at this point, very few decks, if any, don't play cards that are at least 5, 6, 7 plus in ink, trying to get to the late game to be able to compete, because yeah, most games are not typically over by that point. But you can lose a game by that point by running out of resources and are not being able to keep up with your opponent, even if their lore count isn't 20. Emerald has ways, especially with one of the newest cards, it's a legendary Bell Hidden Archer, is going to be brutal if it works out the way that we think it's going to work. So it's a 5-cost uninkable with 3 lore and 3 attack, 3 defense that says you can shift it for 3, so you can cheat it out early. And it says whenever this character is challenged, the challenging character's player discards all of the cards in their hand. You have to ditch your entire hand if you don't have from hand single target removal to be able to get rid of Bell. Even if you have a rush minion to throw out and get rid of Bell, that's still considered a challenge and you'll have to ditch your entire hand.
Yeah.
So if they shift it on 3, you are so far behind. Mm-hmm. And they've released a 3-cost Bell, and I would imagine they're probably going to release a cheaper Bell as well, so that way you can possibly get Bell out on curve on 3.
Yeah.
So I would expect maybe like a stat stick style base Bell to come out like a 1-2
like
or something
cost
like that.
Or something.
Like, I think it's going to be like a 1-cost 1-2 of some sort that's just basic. It's like her like reading a book.
No,
or like
what it needs to be is like Town Weirdo or something. You know how she goes to the town, everybody, it's like they have that whole song about it.
Yeah, insulting the baker. I don't know.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah,
because that's one of the most that's one of the funniest things from that song. He's like, "Oh, the same old rolls to sell," and he's like, "Well, screw you! Like, my stuff is good.
It's good. Yeah, you know, don't mess with the recipe that works, right?
What are you on Yelp?
Yeah, geez, Louise Bell.
So they've got a lot of discard synergy here. I think another card that I'd like to just mention. That's going to be really, really fun to play is Prince John, greediest of all. It's a 3-cost 1/2, so undervalued. And that is a theme that we are going to see with Emerald. It's really powerful.
They're weak.
It's really powerful effects, really solid lore counts, but understated. So you are may only get the effect of each card off once or twice because your opponent theoretically should be able to trade into and get a board control on you. But you should be outvaluing them in the lore game, and you should be outvaluing them with your effects if you are doing it correctly. I think Emerald is a very high skill expression ink color.
I also want to share that I think Emerald has the most amount of uninkables this set of any of the things I've seen so far.
It's going to be choose your battles.
It's absolutely going to. It's also like you can't play all of them. Yeah. Like you cannot play all of these discard cards together because most of them are uninkable. So, you know, I also want to throw out too, there's a second sort of sub theme going on here. Now last, set, there was a lot of theming around playing actions. Now, unfortunately there's not a ton of support for that. However, a few actions we've seen in green, have been really unique in that they replace themselves in your hand after being played. So there's a Hypnotize card with Ka from Jungle Book, the snake, makes your opponent discard a card, but then you get to redraw. You also have Improvise, which is a really great card with Mulan fighting with the fan on the rooftop, which is just great.
Get off the roof.
Looks like you're out of ideas. Not quite. Really good stuff. So anyways, that's another one that gives +1 attack to a character, something that you see green seems to have ways to boost people's attack pretty handily, and it replaces itself. It draws a card. So there's some neat synergies going on there around like the actions replacing themselves. And then there's this sub theme that I'm really not convinced about, which is doing things to already damaged characters. Now, I say that and that green has really no way to get characters damaged without interacting with them through challenges, which of course will happen throughout the game, but also is not something that you can fully control. There's also healing in the game, right? And I will be very interested to see if they're going to be able to put something together, a deck that can really capitalize on the sub theme of damaging characters, then doing things to those damaged characters, because my favorite card so far, or one of them at least, is the new Cheshire Cat.
Yes, it's so interesting.
It's so interesting. The artwork is really goofy and fun. Like, I don't even know, goofy, creepy, funny, cute, all at the same time. It's the Cheshire Cat, right? 8-cost 5/6, shift 5, evasive, but the cool part is that it allows you to activate it, which is a strong card, a strong effect when also paired with evasive, and destroy a damaged character. So it allows you to use it instead of questing to eliminate high profile threats that your opponent has if you can get them damaged. And then because it's evasive, it's going to be hard to immediately challenge it, and it'll be up again the next turn, hopefully, to do it all again. So really cool card. Is it going to be easy enough to get things damaged by working with other factions like Steel or you know, I don't know, Ruby? Steel's really the main one that does damage. It remains to be seen, but I'm very excited about that.
I think this is the avenue in which Emerald, because some historically, some ink colors have not been, they've been like the primary focus of a deck. And like you'll see out of what, of 40 card deck, 60 card deck.
Mm-hmm.
How many cards are in a deck?
60.
Yeah, that's what I thought. I was like, I'm second guessing myself. Like out of a 60 card deck, more often than not, you see like a 45-15 split or like a 40-20 split where Emerald is the majority in decks that it's involved in because it is the primary part of a strategy.
Yeah.
I think the dealing damage to damaged characters or banishing damaged characters is going to be Emerald's avenue to being a supplementary color in a deck for a color that does that better.
Yeah.
Or is a more board focused, like you could even shoot, you could even have a princess deck if it was more board focused and could able, was able to handle some trades. Mm-hmm. You could bop everything, heal everything with your princesses and then play, play a damage card. Like there's a new, damage focused action called Pack Tactics. It's a 4-cost inkable action in Emerald. Gain 1 lore for each damage character your opponents have in play. Mm-hmm. So like that's a way to like boost your lore count off of an action off of damage characters. Like there, I think it's going to be a supplementary way for Emerald to be involved in a different deck, a different color strategy. So overall, I think Emerald is going to be really, really good coming out of, and maybe is going to receive one of the biggest boosts coming out of Chapter 2 from what we've seen so far. There are some other nuances and things like that, but it's going to be one of the best classes to get high lore counts and continue to put pressure on your opponent's lore or by keeping up with you. So
yeah, definitely an interesting angle on that. I will say I want to move over to Ruby next because this is probably the faction I'm most excited for because it's also the faction I've been the least excited for throughout the first chapter because similar in a way to Amethyst, but in a much less accessible avenue, a lot of the cards in red were being farmed into other strategies or were just control. So red had some great control options, Be Prepared, Dragonfire, that are powerful but dull. I think it's fair to say Dragonfire is not a particularly like exciting, interesting card. It's pay 5, kill something. Right? Be prepared. Yeah. Pay 7, wipe the board. Right? Cool cards, powerful cards. Aladdin is probably the most exciting card in all of red. But there's a lot of really bad cards in red. A lot. Probably disproportionately. And yet, red has some themes that felt interesting but underutilized. They have a lot of rush cards. They have ability to give rush to other things. They have ability to ready things with the sword of truth, shield of truth, the shield, not the sword, the shield of truth. And then they have things like LeFou, which can also ready things, right? So they've got these packages. The problem is that there's a dearth of usable characters in red that are not priced at like 5 or higher. Now you've got great cards at like 5 where you got like, you know, the evasive Goofy, you've got the Maui, right? At 7, you've got Aladdin at 9, you've got Maleficent, but in that early game, you've got like a handful of cards that are either just stat sticks. You've got some cards that are like rush but uninkable, like the Peter Pan, which is just a too big of a downside for not big enough of an upside. You've got some evasives, but the evasives are like really understated and don't do anything else. So what we're seeing from Red Ruby is an expansion on those themes. More evasive, but evasives with different stat distributions, lower costs, right? You're seeing cards with more things that can steal or make your opponent lose lore. You're seeing more options with different stat distributions and, you know, different costs for rush characters. And then you're seeing payoff cards, cards that'll encourage you to trade with your opponent. Mm-hmm. So you see this awesome Shere Khan, which in my opinion is the pivotal card in a new strategy, which is encouraging you to actively fight your opponents, both evasives and non-evasives, which says whenever one of your characters challenges another character, gain a lore. Another card that allows you to pull, if you have 4 cards on the board and you play down Shere Khan, you can theoretically challenge with 4 cards and gain 4 lore from, you know, without your opponent realizing you could do that. And so you're seeing a lot of in doubling down on these previously not particularly good mechanics. And I'm really excited to see how those pan out. The new Radagon, right, from The Great Mouse Detective, another classic underappreciated old Disney movie, right, allows you to, when you play it, you get to exert an enemy character 3 or less and then choose one of your characters and ready them so that they can immediately challenge, right? So I'm excited to also report that as far as Red goes, so far we are seeing very little that is going to push the control archetype much further. You see Scar, there's a 7-cost Scar, which has got Rush on it and decent stats, but I don't think that will end up seeing play compared to Maui, with very similar stats at 2-cost less that's also inkable. So the only time you might see Scar see play is in a deck that wants to be actively challenging aggressively throughout the course of the game, as opposed to more of a mid-range approach, as opposed to a control approach. So that's my read on it. Gibby, what are some cards that stand out in Ruby for you as, like, this is the most interesting thing going on here?
Well, you've mentioned a couple of them already, being Shere Khan and Radagon. I'm kind of looking through the list here to see if there's anything else that really catches my eye right now.
You know, Dinner Bell's an interesting one. I didn't.
Dinner Bell is an interesting, and I would think, somewhat controversial card about whether we think it will be impactful.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not convinced that Dinner Bell will see that much play, if anything. I also think we haven't received a whole lot of Ruby cards yet. Like, I think that it might have been one of the lesser revealed colors so far. I do expect us to receive some more exciting characters to kind of get the player base hype as we get closer to release day. But there's not really much else that I want to highlight outside.
I think the Queen of Hearts 2-drop we talked a lot about in our texts. Mm-hmm. I think maybe we didn't agree, but I think that's a really impactful card to have in the game.
Yeah. I think there's also, I think maybe Honest John is not a bad card. It's a 3-cost uninkable that says every time you play a Floodborne character, each opponent loses a lore. So it's a way for you to repeatedly kind of control your opponent's lore count to get you to the late game, with Ray Ruby being one of the best late game classes. Mm-hmm. Might be one of the only the late game support cards that I've seen so far, if you were willing to dip deep into the Floodborne realm.
Yeah. There's going to be a lot more evasives in this set, which is going to heavily alter Ruby's role in the environment, because evasives being that thing that's hard to interact with, and not a lot of other factions directly have evasives themselves. While we will see an increase in cards that can challenge evasives, it's always going to be on the lookout for cards that expand the consistency of a full evasive package. So let's move on to blue. Gibby, what's noteworthy about Sapphire?
So Sapphire is a class that is getting quite a bit of shift from what I can tell. And that makes sense to me, because Sapphire, one of the best things that they did from Chapter 1 was be able to ramp. They were like the premier ramp class, having one jump ahead, Grandma Tala on 2 to be able to, and Detective Mickey on 3. So having a 1-cost, a 2-cost, and a 3-cost card that could ramp your Inkwell to be able to get to late game cards faster. And with a lot of the whole point of Floodborne characters being a little overstated, or not a little overstated, a little overcosted, with the ability for you to shift into them, that makes sense for Sapphire, that they would have quite a bit of shift amounts throughout the entire mid game, early game, and late game. We're seeing in Sapphire maybe what I would consider one of the least focused packages from any of the colors. I don't know if you would agree with that or not. But hopefully we're going to see continued item synergy.
I'm not impressed.
I think it's going to be less obvious what a deck is coming out of Sapphire.
There's some neat individual cards for sure.
That's exactly it. There's some very useful, very neat individual cards that are going to be coming out of Sapphire, but it's not necessarily going to be any, like, there's not going to be a obvious 2, 3, 4, and 5. There's going to be no 7 Dwarves deck that comes out of, at least from what we know right now, out of Sapphire. A card, for example, that I think is an individual that is really, really good, I plan on playing quite a bit if I can get my hands on it. It is a super rare, is Grand Pabby. It's a 7-cost uninkable for three attack, 6 defense. Got 3 lore itself, and it says whenever you remove 1 or more damage from one of your characters, gain 2 lore. So, and that's for each character that you remove a damage from. So you can very easily close out a game with Grand Pabby by just dropping him and then healing a bunch of things in like getting to 6 or 7 lore quickly. It, like, it's so good of a card. I think Gaston, Intellectual Powerhouse, is a really interesting card. When you play this character, it's a 6-cost uninkable for 4/4 that you can shift for 4, so you can get it out early. It's got 3 lore to it, which is a little uncommon for what could be a mid-range card within Sapphire if you can shift it. When you play this character, look at the top 3 cards of your deck. You may put one into your hand, put the rest on the bottom of your deck in any order. We see a little bit of hand manipulation kind of styles from Chapter 1 in Sapphire, but that mainly lies within Amethyst. So Sapphire is always kind of this class that, yeah, it has the ramping focus, but it feels like it's kind of a jack of all trades. It does a little bit of everything. It is a really good splash category to enable other decks to be able to do other strategies. I think we're going to see a little bit more of a support focus as well. I think outside of maybe some of the challenging from Ruby and some of the board-centric healing focus from Amber, I think Sapphire is also going to be another board-centric, probably in a tertiary status, another board-centric ink color, but it's like the support color of all of them. Like it's an enabler. Like, it's got a little bit of evasive. It's got a little bit of shift. It's got a little bit of a ward. It's got some new cards that are coming out that have the support tag on them. Playing for Floodborns, like a little bit of new card draw. When you play this character or when this character quests, you can banish one of your items to draw 2 cards. That's Hiram Flaversham, the toy maker. So that's like, they do a little bit of everything. So I don't think that there's going to be any one big takeaway from Sapphire outside of they've got some really cool individual cards that should all be considered when you're building your deck, because it might Sapphire, if you don't find an obvious choice to complement a deck in any other color, Sapphire will always be a good backup option.
Yeah, I'd like to profile one thing that I think is going to be interesting, which is the Basil, the Great Mouse Detective. He's got a package of 3 cards on the surface. I think that those cards probably don't seem particularly flashy. One of them is a 2/2 for 2 that has support. Another one is a 4-cost 3/4 with 2 questing with blank. And then the last one is the one that's really impressive, the 6-cost Great Mouse Detective Basil that has shift 5. But then if you use shift to bring him in, you immediately draw 2 cards. So in theory, if you can shift him in for 5 after playing the 2 or the 4 cost the turn before, you shift him in for 5, immediately draw 2 cards, and can immediately quest for 3 because the ink will have dried on the previous version. Now, I think that's pretty good. I don't think it's necessarily bonkers, but I do think it's pretty good. Now, Sapphire is very limited card draw so far. So that and Gaston being these 6-cost card draw things, like, they're clearly designating that, like, not a lot of early game card draw in blue. They don't want blue to have a ton of early game card draw. However, right. I'll also point out that this is another iteration of the detective keyword. So does that mean we're going to see some detective synergy with that and Mickey Mouse Detective? Remains to be seen.
Yeah, we don't know yet, but like we said, we have to see what the back half of the set's going to look like. All right, round us out with maybe one of your specialties here, which is steel.
I think at this point, probably, I don't know if it's fair to say steel is a specialty of mine anymore, but it might be after this set comes out, because there's some really cool stuff in here. So steel got a pretty high profile new keyword called resist. This is brand new. You only see it in steel and on one action card in Sapphire, and that is basically all damage dealt to the character gets reduced by 2 while you have, or gets reduced by however much the resist is, and the resist could be more. I think we've seen resist 2 more than anything else, but there's a resist 1 on a character. So what that means is they're really leaning into, similar to Amber, a board centric strategy for steel, but with the spin of resiliency. These characters coming in, they are not sitting here to come in, whereas I think a lot of Amber characters want to come in, swarm the board, and quest primarily. Steel wants to come in and challenge and defend primarily, right? They want to be taking value trades as often as possible. So you see this mix of cards, cards that have high questing values, but have, resist to keep them alive for longer. Something like Tiana, which is a 4-cost uninkable with 1/4, but resist 2 to main, so that you would really need an attack of 6 to get Tiana down. And Tiana quests for 2, and when it's exerted and you have no more cards, opponents can't play actions. That's kind of wild. So there's some pretty cool stuff going on. And again, the main actions that people play being a lot of removal. So you're really setting yourself up for a, you know, maybe not a super rich card draw hand, but a lot of, things that are hard to remove efficiently. And that's pretty much everything that is going on in Steel. Now, they continue to have card effects that draw and then immediately discard to shape your hand, but that aren't netting new cards for you. They also have a handful of new bodyguard cards. I think high profile is the prince. Now, I think it's really funny that in Cinderella, there is just a character called the prince. The boy toy just doesn't get a name. all right, we'll roll with it. We also have the queen, so she doesn't get a name either. So I guess all's fair in fairy tale characters. Really cool because it's a bodyguard, which we had some cool synergies in the previous set with the Musketeers Tabard. This one has resist 1 and a 2 questing line, which is really neat because not a lot of the bodyguards can quest for a whole lot. So very cool stuff there. It's a little more spread out across the board. We're seeing a mix of things that can challenge evasive units like Li Shang from Mulan. We also are seeing some great cards like Jafar, which is intended to be able to gain evasive on the turn and challenge. And the Shift Jafar, which is the one I'm most excited about. The 4-cost Jafar Dreadnought, a Floodborne version of Jafar that can shift in for 2. That whenever on your turn, whenever it banishes a character and challenge, you get to draw a card. This is one of the very, very few Steel cards actually nets you a card. And with you being able to shift it in, you will have already had the ink dry and can immediately make an attack and hopefully capitalize. Some really cool stuff. And then in terms of Steel's late game, something that I don't think that there was a lot of great options outside of Giant Tinkerbell for late game threats from Steel specifically. We've got Goofy, Knight for a Day, which is a ridiculous 9 cost with 10 stats and 4 questing pips.
It's so ridiculous.
It's so ridiculous, but the art is fantastic. But then more importantly, you have the Cinderella Stouthearted, the 7-cost inkable Floodborne Cinderella that shifts in for 5. It has resist 2, so very tough to take down. And whenever you play a song, she can immediately challenge readied characters, something that you can't do otherwise. So allowing Cinderella to take something down as soon as they come down, that can really help in the late game. If your Emerald aggro opponent is they're at 18 and they're out of cards, but they top deck a Mad Hatter and they slam the Mad Hatter down. If you can't get rid of it that turn with it being readied, which means you can't challenge it unless you can get it exhausted, you're in trouble. So some really cool things allowing and hopefully enabling Steel to be the preeminent combat faction. So really cool stuff going on there. Any final cards you want to highlight from Steel, Gibby?
I will highlight real quick the, oh goodness, where is it? The Robin Hood Capable Fighter card. It is a 2-cost 1/3 for 1 lore that says you can just tap the card instead of questing with it to deal 1 damage to a chosen character. So that will help you trade safely from distance with in the early game and kind of whittle down their board. But it also is an enablement for some of those emerald cards that we were talking about that do effects off of the damage characters. So this is more or less where we could see, I think everyone's kind of theoretically in their head building Emerald Steel as going to be one of the premier decks that come out of chapter 2 with this tick away damage from far. There's already the 4-cost Hans 13th in line that every time you quest with it, you also can deal 1 damage to an opposing character. So being able to have this balanced of, I don't have to damage my characters, but I can slowly whittle away and chink at your armor
away with your on your characters and then use effects from Emerald to be able to banish or damage further your characters, I think is a deck strategy that we will see. I think more or less what I take away from Steel is that it is going to be one of the best reactive classes, along with I think along with Ruby being having the rush to be able to see what's on board, determined to play a rush unit and clear what it needs to, or having some of the better removal tools with Be Prepared and Dragon Fires and stuff like that. I think through effects and through maybe a bit more combat focus, I think Steel just has a multitude of ways to survey the board, evaluate it properly, and deal with your opponent through a carefully constructed strategy of a wide variety of different approaches.
Yeah. Well, that is going to wrap up our analysis and our fun preview segment of Rise of the Floodborne, which is going to be coming out in just a few short weeks. It will be in local game stores starting on the 17th, I believe. So middle of the month there. And then it should be in full release in big box stores on December 1st. So definitely go check that out if you're interested in Lorcana. If you have any more questions about Lorcana or you want to get connected with some of the ideas we have, any content that we are familiar with or recommendations for content to consume regarding Lorcana and getting started, definitely join the Discord. We have a section for Lorcana, which has been very active of late as everybody looks at all of the new cards that are coming out and being previewed. And there will be much more to come, I'm sure. So right now, we are going to quickly cut over to our live from the field report from our beloved Pokemon correspondent, Curry, who's going to break down the new set, Paradox Rift.
Hey, Legends Cast listeners. Some of you may remember me as the Pokemon guy from back when I was a guest on the show when Mark and DBN were discussing TCG Live as their monthly topic. Well, the Legends themselves have asked me to come back and give you all the scoop on the latest offerings of the Pokemon TCG with the release of its newest set, Paradox Rift. With the release of Paradox Rift, we see the introduction of a new split-themed mechanic showcasing the aptly named Paradox Pokemon, featured in the Scarlet and Violet video games. The ancient Pokemon, such as Roaring Moon EX, Sandy Shocks EX, and Screamtail, focus on big damage with sub-themes of energy and HP manipulation, while the future Pokemon interact with the enemy Pokemon in a less direct way than their Unga Bunga brothers, such as damage spreading via Iron Valiant EX's ability, Iron Hands EX being able to take extra prize cards following a successful knockout with its Amp You Very Much attack, and Iron Bundle's ability to force your opponent to switch their active Pokemon with one of their bench. Both ancient and future Pokemon have tool cards associated with them. The ancient Booster Energy Capsule gives ancient Pokemon it is attached to an additional 60 HP and immunity to special conditions. And the future Booster Energy Capsule provides the future Pokemon it is attached to free retreat costs and an extra 20 damage on its attacks. Both spectrums of the Paradox Pokemon are likely to receive continued support with future set releases, so I expect that most of these cards will make an impact at some point during their TCG lifecycle. Additionally, some fan-favorite Pokemon return as chase cards, with Garchomp EX as a Water Terra type hitting for a solid 160 damage for a single fighting energy, and giving some much-needed energy acceleration to the fighting type. And the TCG debut of Golden Go, everyone's favorite string cheese monster, as a powerful EX card that allows you to draw additional cards on your turn, as well as output obscene amounts of damage by discarding energy cards from your hand with its signature Make It Rain attack. The set also brings back the concept of Technical Machines, or TMs, which can be attached to Pokemon to provide players more options, such as the ability to evolve two of your bench Pokemon, or accelerate energy from your deck to those bench Pokemon to expedite your setup. Stocks of Town Store are definitely on the rise with all of these new tool cards to fetch. The previously niche stadium card released in Obsidian Flames has gained a lot of powerful new targets with the release of Paradox Rift and is poised to be heavily included in many new and continuing archetypes moving forward. These have been some quick highlights of the marquee mechanics and cards, but there are other gems in the set that I don't have time to cover here. In my opinion, this is easily the strongest set that has been released in the Scarlet and Violet block. As has become standard, the set has a full suite of full art and illustration rare cards that are absolutely gorgeous, so collectors and art enjoyers alike can still appreciate this more competitively focused set. I'm personally a big fan of the illustration rares for both Roaring Moon EX and Iron Valiant EX, and will be looking to pick them up at some point. I'm in the Discord if anyone has any questions, and I'm more than happy to discuss the game with people, as I'm sure DBN can attest to. I'm Curry. This has been the inaugural instance of Curry's Corner, title pending. Now let's get you back to your regularly scheduled Legends Cast content.
And thank you for that report, Curry. It's our first field report that we've done, that's right. So it's exciting to be able to take a look at another game kind of in the middle of the episode. And just give you a little bit of a snapshot at something else outside of what the main topic is. Pokemon is never in shortage of our conversation list on in all facets on Legends Cast between Unite, our other podcast of AOS Airwaves, the TCG, which I know you and Curry both play quite often, and just other Pokemon in general. It's an IP that we all love. So
yes, very beloved.
We appreciate Curry taking the time. As a member of our community, to give us the expert opinions of the new set.
And if you are interested in potentially serving as our future correspondents for other games that we've either played and left behind, something like Runeterra or Gwent, or a game that we have not yet tried out, and there's something new coming to that game, message us in the Discord and we may be able to set up something similar. We would eventually love to expand our network of game correspondents into the next year.
Yeah, send us your resume and we'll
that's right.
See what
we'll
can
consult
do.
Your resume. We'll connect you with HR. You know the deal. All right. Just to close out, Gibby, you know, we're trying something new here. We're closing out with our reverse banter. Instead of asking, you know, what did you play last week? Tell me, what are you excited to play? Any cool new gaming opportunities coming up for you in the following week? And we can check back next week to see how it goes.
Yeah, so you won't probably have a response from me about it because it'll still be in the future beyond next week. But I am playing in a Lorcana local release event for Rise of the Floodborn that we've agreed, for those of you that I've talked to in the Lorcana chat, is just an insane value that my local game store is running.
It's crazy. It's a crazy
value. It's awesome.
Value.
So I'm going to get for 40 bucks or 45 bucks, I get both of the starter decks that also come with a sleeved like booster pack in each of them, mm-hmm. per standard of the starter decks, three booster packs along with that. And then you have to build, you have like 30 minutes to build a 60 card deck of two colors, kind of like in a draft style format, and then play a best two out of three tournament, mini tournament. And then at the end of the event, you will also get another booster pack as well for having competed in all four rounds. So slots were limited. I got my slot nailed away early on. That's on November 18th. So I'm really excited to be able to play that. And that will hopefully be the jump start of the beginning of my collection for Rise of the Floodborn as well. And I will be happy to tell you about how some of the cards feel, some of the strategies that I saw, what colors performed well or didn't perform well versus others. Looking forward to us getting into Monster Train and overall just me getting back into gaming from having a new addition to my family, which I know I've mentioned on a couple of different episodes. So I'm about a month removed, maybe a month and a half from the birth of our daughter, Aubrey. And we've taken the time to focus on family, but I'll be getting back into hopefully into D&D this week,
yes,
with which DBN is our DM. I'm looking forward to that. Getting back maybe even to playing into a little bit of Rocket League. I really haven't touched my PS4 in quite some time either. And then we're also competing, you and I both, in a cash tournament.
That's right.
For Pokemon Unite this weekend. We got invited. We got a private
Our team merited an invitation. That's big for us. We're usually not that good. Us getting an invitation, we will certainly take it. That's super exciting. I think for me, the big thing that I'm really amped about is getting in on Monster Train. I'm going to download it on my Switch and just go crazy with it and really dive in, because I think I'm at a nice little stopping point, like with a lot of the other games where I'm like, the new Pokemon set came out and I've been like so immersed in that. And I'm just now resurfacing, got some, you know, new decks I'm going to be working on, but like, you know, consumed so much Pokemon content. And then of course, Lorcana waiting on that. So to fill the gap between now and then, Monster Train, baby, let's go. Can't wait to try it out. I saw like some gameplay of it. I got myself hyped for it. Gibby's been hyping it up. So I'm really excited to dive into a new single player game, which we haven't done since Frost you always get it. Something Frost.
Frost. Wild Frost.
Wild Frost. Guys, like, y'all, this is, I mess it up every time. Wild Frost. That's the one. Anyway,
there's Frost Haven. There's Frost Morn, which is like a thing for like Hearthstone.
That's from Hearthstone. Yeah. I'll remember Wild
Wendy's
Frost.
Frosty.
Frosties. That sounds even better. I'll go get a Frosty.
We're approaching
this week.
Christmas. Frosty the Snowman. Come on now.
There's too many Frost things. You heard it here first. Thank you all so much for listening. We're going to go ahead and get on out of here. But once again, don't forget to join the Discord. Enjoy some of the discussion going on there about all of the various games. Gibby's chuckling at me for some.
You
for some
almost
reason.
Said pin your lanes.
I did not say that. I did not. That's the wrong show. I'm a professional and we're out of here. Thank you so much for listening. We will see you next time.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Legends Cast. You can join our podcast community by joining Discord using the link in the description of this episode. You can become a supporter of the show by visiting patreon.com/camplegend. And don't forget to check out all of the other shows in the Camp Legend Podcast Network.